All right, I think we'll go ahead and get started. Welcome to this session of the Sunstone Symposium. It is session 154, two-paper session. It's on bridges burned, bridges built. Personal reflections on faith journeys. Just a couple reminders. This is being recorded, so if you could maybe take the time now to silence your cell phone. I'll do that too. And then, let's see, we want to announce the book sales that you can find over there, and Sunstone gets a percentage of the money when you purchase books there, so go ahead and head over there. Make sure you visit. And let's see here. So let me go ahead and just introduce the guest. First, we're going to hear from Hillary Brown, and she lives in Utah. Sorry, she lives in Salt Lake City and attends the University of Utah. And she enjoys cooking, crocheting, and making art and writing. We have also heard here from Stephen Shields, who was the president of the John Whitmer Historical Association from 2011 to 2012. He's an independent historian who is best known as the author of Divergent Paths of the Restoration. He has published widely and has served for several years on the editorial boards of Restoration Studies and John Whitmer Historical Association Journal. He also edited for several years the annual transactions of the Royal Asiatic Society of Korea branch. Raised in Utah's pioneer heritage, Mormon, Steve joined the Community of Christ more than 30 years ago. He has lived and worked in several countries in Asia, including Korea, for 12 years, where he was a missionary, pastor, president of the Community of Christ East Asia Mission Center. Having served the church in full-time roles since 1987, he is currently assigned to the church's international headquarters in Independence, Missouri. And then we also are going to hear from Vijay Burton, who is the author of Sunstone's Braving the Borderlands column. And also, he has a really great website at forthosewhowonder.com, where you can get his book and kind of get some of the different materials that he has. But we'll go ahead and start out with Hillary.
I left activity in the church 6 years ago. I was a lifelong member, born into the covenant, and I've been active and dedicated my entire life. I graduated from seminary. I attended BYU Idaho. I have always carefully looked for the good things about the church. Community, family, service. I also carefully tried to shut my eyes to the uglier sides of the LDS culture, like the push for homogeneity that can lead to extreme bullying within the church. But 6 years ago, the church involved itself in Prop 8, and I couldn't shut my eyes anymore. The viciousness and bullying I saw then were hideous. I tried to attend church, but I would end up sitting in the foyer and shaking and crying. And wondering where my religion had gone. How this gospel of love had been turned into a weapon of hate. So I left. On a Sunday, after a particularly heated discussion about LGBTQ rights and feminism, in which my dedication to the gospel was questioned by a family member, I went home and took off my garments. I finally realized that the church didn't want me. This is a story I've told before. This is a story I've told at Sunstone. What I'd like to talk about is why I stay away from a church I really do love. And how my decision to leave is reinforced by family, friends, and the church itself on a fairly regular basis. On October 5th, 2013, Dieter Uthoff spoke in general conference to those who have left the church and those who have doubts about the church. I no longer watch or listen to general conference, but I know about this talk and have read it because many, many people sent me copies of the talk. One might say a plethora of people. They sent me copies and they told me how much I was valued, how much each and every person is valued by God and by the church. It was a lovely talk. My heart was warm. I felt hopeful. I'm as certain as a human can be that I'm not returning to church. But this talk gave me that tiny bit of optimism. I hope that someday I could sit in on a meeting without hurting and without having to distract myself. This hope was tenuous at best, though, and I'm no longer optimistic. My journey out of the church was excruciating. I returned to church week after week, thinking I might find something there for me. Some sign that God loved me and wanted me in his flock. I read my scriptures every day, for hours, and took so many notes that I have a box of composition books buried in my sister's garage, filled with references and cross-references in every possible interpretation. I prayed and prayed and prayed. It was too late, though. I'd come to the understanding that in the church I was not seen as equal. I didn't even feel equal. I recognized the condescension in the talks about the divine role of women. I knew that this pedestal was a prison, and I'd come to value myself. I wasted years blaming myself for the anger and depression I felt when faced with the church's paradoxes and the ways I simply didn't fit in. The year I left, I realized my life was valuable. I'd spent too much time asking God to let me die and end the pain. There was a turning point, though. Survival became more important than salvation. I've been told this is wrong. I've been told that I should have worked harder, endured more pain. I've been told I should have rather died than leave God's church. I know that isn't true. I cannot believe in a God who would want me to hurt in such a way. If there were such a God, I would hate him. That would be a greater sin than simple disbelief. So, dear Earth's words, sometimes we assume it is because they have been offended or lazy or sinful. Actually, it is not that simple. In fact, there is not just one reason that applies to the variety of situations. Some of our dear members struggle for years with the question of whether they should separate themselves from the church. In this church that honors personal agency so strongly that it was restored by a young man that had questions and sought answers, we respect those who honestly search for truth. We're a comfort. I hope that those who accuse me of sin or being offended or hating the church would take his words to heart. I hope that they would treat me and many people I know who left the church with compassion, kindness, and understanding. I don't doubt the sincerity of President Ukdorf, and I don't doubt the sincerity of those who send copies of and links to his talk. But that isn't how things work. We're human. Members of the church are human. I am human. In the midst of all these letters and emails and Facebook links to Dieter Ukdorf's talk, I was also seeing jokes about liberals and feminists, and very specifically about ordained women. Just a year after Dieter Ukdorf's address, it was popular to link to Andy Kano's blog post, "Some LDS women want the priesthood." Well, LDS men have some requests, too. In his list of male requests for equality from the church, he states, "How come there is a mother's lounge and not a father's lounge? Women get to nurse and feed their baby in a dark, quiet room, while fathers have to walk around the church looking for an empty classroom or use the stand and sway method to put babies to sleep. Even if we find an unused classroom, we don't have a rocking chair. We want padded seats in our meeting room, too. Do you know what men have? We have cold, hard, metal chairs. Are not all bottoms created equal? Male enrichment. After we graduate from scouting, we get one, maybe two activities a year for men, typically a shooting guns activity with barbecue. But we want monthly activities like women. Let's even up those budgets a little, huh?" Some would call his post petty, and it is. It would be petty to argue with him, but he gets his point across. He thinks he, an expert on women, thinks things are better for women the way they are, and that ordained women is just a small community of agitators with nothing better to do with their time than inflame the public about something that is not really a problem. The women are being silly. Having the priesthood is hard. It is a burden. Women shouldn't ask for it. This is an argument I've heard so many times before I can recite it. I know the tone of voice in which it is said. I know the gestures with which it is accompanied. It is an argument that is petty and easily refuted. It is boring. Yes. It is one I don't even engage with because the arguer doesn't make it to the point of discourse. The arguer will not be convinced. This post was made shortly before Spring General Conference. Shortly after Spring Conference, Kylie Ruth wrote a guest post for the Millennial Star entitled, "Ordained Women Thanks for Nothing." In this post, she claims she will never join ordained women because to unite myself with their cause is to admit somehow that I am less because I do not hold the priesthood. This argument presents some unique straw men. First, it implies that those who have joined ordained women movement believe that they are less because they do not hold the priesthood. I have never heard this argument used by any member of ordained women. I would say, though, that it is apparent to any thinking person outside of the LDS Church that LDS women are being treated unequally by not being allowed to hold the priesthood. Why would women believe this? Let's look at the definition of priesthood according to LDS.org. The word priesthood has two meanings. First, priesthood is the power and authority of God. It has always existed and will continue to exist without end. Through the priesthood, God created and governs the heavens and the earth. Through his power, he exalts his obedient children, bringing to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. Second, immortality, priesthood is the power and authority that God gives man to act in all things necessary for the salvation of God's children. The blessings of the priesthood are available to all who receive the gospel. The church itself defines priesthood as the power and authority to act as God. If that power is only given to half of God's children, there is a power imbalance. That seems very apparent. To ask for an equal amount of power is not to declare oneself unequal. The second straw man Ruth presents is when she declares she will never join ordained women. That's all well and good, but that statement also has certain implications. Was Kylie Ruth asked to join ordained women? Did someone pass her a note during Relief Society or Sunday school inviting her to a secret ordained women meeting held in the mother's lounge so they could, of course, avoid the men who don't get their own lounge? I'm quite certain ordained women would take Ruth if she wanted to join, but membership is not compulsory. Women are whipped and beaten until they conform to the feminist ideal of asking for the priesthood and disdaining beauty products. Nope, that's not how feminism works, and that's not how ordained women works. I'm not even a member of ordained women. I've somehow slipped from their grasp, and I know that's not how it works. I could go through the entirety of the piece and pull out the straw men one by one until I had enough straw to light the sky in a dangerous and beautiful fire. Ruth knows she is equal because she feels equal, she is strong, she is a leader in the home, she went on a mission, she comes from a history of strong women. Each of her claims contains within it the implication that somehow the women of working women are other, they aren't strong, they don't feel equal, they don't have positive female role models. My point isn't to pick apart these posts, though. I'd rather know why they are written and why they go viral in Mormon circles. Why is it necessary to mock and trivialize women who ask questions? Is it fear? Is it a need for reassurance? Do the members who post and joke about these feel any cognitive dissonance when they also send links to Elder Isidore's talk to former members and inactive members like me? These blog posts are a small thing. Anyone who's read the comment section of the Salt Lake Tribune knows insults fly in both directions. Former members are accused of being anti-Mormon. Current members are called sheep. Anyone who tries to walk the middle way is invited to leave. Leave the church, leave the state, leave wherever they are, leave whoever they are. They just need to leave. Elder Uthendorf's talk was beautiful and reassuring, but these words send a stronger message. Kate Kelly's excommunication and the cruelty and mockery I saw toward her and her struggle from Mormons in the wake of that excommunication sends a far stronger message than the talk does. Elder Uthendorf said, "To those who have separated themselves from the church, I say, my dear friends, there is yet a place for you here. The words and actions of church members show me there is not." Elder Uthendorf said, "If you could see into our hearts, you would probably find that you fit in better than you suppose. You might be surprised to find that we have yearnings and struggles and hopes similar to yours. Your background and upbringing might seem different from what you perceive in many Latter-day Saints, but that could be a blessing. Brothers and sisters, dear friends, we need your unique talents and perspectives. The diversity of opinion, persons and peoples all around the globe is a strength of this church." The excommunication of Kate Kelly and the glee so many members found in that showed me I do not fit in. My diversity, my unique talents, my perspectives are not wanted. You invite me to church, but you do not want me. You want a paper doll cutout of me. You want a person who sits quietly in a pretty, modest dress with her arms folded and her mouth shut. I am not that person. My conscience will not allow me to be that person. When I see injustice and inequality, I must speak up. I have done so since I was a child. I have been punished for it, but it is my best quality. As you may suppose, I've been invited back to church a number of times. I have been really aggressively fellowshipped, and I usually don't mind. I know the pressure members are under to be missionaries and to bring their apostate friends and family back to church. I fellowship people, so I understand why so many members feel the need to fellowship me. I'm also not willing to cut ties with my friends and family over the church. So if I'm invited back, I'll say a happy no thanks and leave it. A lot of the messages they send me are sweet and loving, if misguided. They're misguided because they don't want me to come back to church. If I came back to church, I'd speak my mind. I'd bear my testimony of feminism, equality, and the importance of marriage, housing, employment, and non-harassment rights for everyone. I would not sustain Boyd K. Packer. I'd say that modesty culture is bunk. I declare that the miracle of forgiveness is one of the most hateful and damaging works ever written. I would not shut up like I shut up for all the years I was a member. I am not the member the church wants, and that's been brought to my attention multiple times in the wake of ordained women and similar movements. The same family and friends who've been inviting me back to church have started posting and reblogging about ordained women. The blogs are mocking, cruel, and a good reminder of why I've left. When I tell those who posted links that drive people away from the church, they seem surprised. They have been missionaries. They have been inviting people to church. How could this sarcastic little blog post or comment drive someone away? That person wouldn't be interested anyway. But others have contacted me privately, telling me that they are also uncomfortable with the bullying nature of these things, wondering if it's worth it to stay. I don't know what to tell them. I think the church needs loud mouths, people with a strong sense of social justice who will speak up when it isn't popular and stand up for their consciences. I sometimes wish I'd been strong enough to stay and help create change, but I'm usually just relieved I don't have to worry about it anymore. The gospel I believed in is one of love. I may no longer have a testimony of the divinity of Christ, but I do believe in his messages of love and acceptance. Christ said, "Come unto me, all ye who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." He didn't say, "Come to church, but please shut up about the things that are bothering you and your silly words about equality. If you were righteous, you wouldn't feel that way." Christ said, "Love thy neighbor." He didn't say, "Profess to love thy neighbor, but make light of their legitimate concerns, make fun of them for their questions, mock them for their sadness and what you perceive to be their sins." He said, "He who is without sin, throw the first stone." He didn't say, "Hey, this lady may have sinned. She's obviously different. Let's cast some stones at her. It will be fun and funny. Her pain is hilarious." I didn't burn my bridges when I left the church. I'm still a member of Record. I didn't go to the nearest TV station and publicly denounce my leaders. Part of me feels like I didn't leave the church. The church left me. And I just grew tired of trying to run after it. My bridges back to the church have been burned again and again. When I read the denunciations of feminists, liberals, intellectuals, and people who are lesbian, gay, bi, trans, or queer, members of the church are continually setting fire to my bridges back to the church. So-called apostates do not drive people from the church. Feminists, intellectuals, and homosexuals are not the greatest threat to the gospel. Bullies drive people from the church. The bullies who condescend to women by telling them they are too holy to hold the priesthood. The bullies who wield the priesthood power as a weapon. The bullies who call women silly or imply they are silly for pointing out equality. The bullies who run from diversity and difference and change. I have not seen an apostate drive a person from the church. I have seen people decide to stay home to avoid the bullies at church. Mormons, you have been burning bridges. You have been inviting us to church, but burning the bridges we need to get there. You are embracing us with one arm and attempting to remold us into something you can love or even accept with the other. You are hurting us. You are hurting yourselves. You are burning bridges.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve, and I'm a Mormon. I am in the Community of Christ. What a lot of LDS folks know would understand being a member of the First Quorum of the 70. We don't call it that, but the calling and the duties are similar. We have mandatory retirement, and we're subject to assignment by the First Presidency. Members of the LDS First Quorum of 70 get to stay until they're 70. I have to retire when Social Security says I have to retire. I'm a sixth-generation member of the Smith Rigdon Restoration Movement. My heritage began in 1837 when my great-great-grandfather was baptized at Kirtland. My sixth generation starts in 1841 in Scotland when my great-great-great-grandfather and his family were baptized. My great-great-grandfather's was Albert Perry Rockwood, and he was from Massachusetts, and his wife and Brigham Young's wife were cousins. And so when the church under Brigham Young went west, it's common to see why family would stick with that. Grandpa Rockwood was actually in the wagon with Brigham Young on that fateful day on July 24th, 1847. He was too delirious with fever to know what was going on until 2 days later. When he got up out of bed and looked around, he said, "Oh my God, Graham, what have you done to us?" Now, the history is painted a lot more romantically than that, but I'm sure they were human, and I'm sure that some of the people just thought Brigham was absolutely wildly nuts. And so I like to imagine that that's why that might be. I don't think my great-great-grandfather was just one of these yes-men that history thinks him out to be. At least I'd like to think he was. Problem with 48-point type is that my pages have three words on them. Month after they arrived in Salt Lake Valley, Grandpa and Brigham Young and some others found the horses and rode all the way back to their quarters. That takes guts. I don't think I have that kind of stamina to be a community builder. When Grandpa finally settled in the valley, some of the family settled in Centerville. There was a fish hatchery at Fairmont Park. Fairmont Park, is that the right park by Sugar House? That was great-great-grandpa Rockwood's fish hatchery. He was the first territorial prison warden. Was a member of the first council of the 70. So I have a fairly long heritage, I think, in the original movement. Family legend has it that the lot of land that's across from the Beehive House belonged to Grandpa, and when Brigham wanted to build the Amelia Palace, he asked Grandpa for it, and he said, "Oh, sure, Brother Brigham, you can have my land." But I'm not sure about the facts on that. Family legends. Meanwhile, in Tulloch County, the Shield side of my family went from Liverpool to New Orleans in 1849, up the river to St. Louis, up the river to Kansas City, where they outfitted at Westport, bypassed winter quarters on the diagonal, came here, and were sent out to Tulloch in 1851. When I was growing up, the Shields family occupied several pages of the local telephone book. There were a lot of us out there. Polygamy being what it was, families were big. My granddad was a bishop, my father was a bishop, but I will only ever be a son of a bishop. Because in the community of Christ, I don't qualify to be a bishop. Because I like to spend money. Growing up, we were all pretty sure that David on the Cave was going to be the last prophet before the second coming. Any of you old enough to remember those sorts of, I guess not. You're not that old. Of course, we had our annual interview with the bishop when he warned all of us young deacons, teachers, and priests of the evils of masturbation and petting. Most of us didn't have a clue what he was talking about, but we knew what the answer was supposed to be. And so we gave him the right answers. So in the days that I grew up, I'm 58, looking forward to going on a mission was strongly encouraged. It wasn't nearly the psyche that is part of the church these days, where they sing about it in the primary and all that. We didn't have those kind of songs that I can recall. And not everybody went. It's kind of like, what's wrong with that family? Everybody expected that, you know, I would do that, and went off to BYU for my first year, and was called on a mission. People were a little upset because I deferred my mission until October so I could work over the summer. And during that summer, I was in Nauvoo working on an archaeology project with BYU Anthropology Archaeology Department. And got to know a few RLDS folk there. There were a few friendly ones. Most of them were somewhat obnoxious. And I'd met several RLDS folk here in the Salt Lake area. Again, you know, it was Bible bashing, not always positive experiences. One of the problems that I had, I think, growing up was that I read a lot. And I read lots of books that weren't necessarily approved by the general authorities. And I was warned against that. And the warnings were right, because see where I ended up. I could quote Mormon doctrine Joseph Finley Smith like a few others. I mean, I really was well read. But I developed a passion for church history. I went to early morning seminary. Even though we could take release time in Utah and do that during the day, I didn't want to miss any of the other wonderful academics that I was interested in. Then my senior year in high school, because the early morning students were considered to be a little more exceptional, we were asked to write term papers, which the regular kids didn't have to do. And so by the time we get to the church history section of the fourth year in seminary, I'd already written 12 term papers up to that point. And so I thought, well, I'll write a term paper about the foolish and false church then known as the RLDS Church. Like anyone could see, Brigham Young's was the only way that succession could possibly have happened, and anyone who would open their eyes could easily see that God only recognized the LDS Church as authoritative. The growth in numbers of members alone proves that. Side note, I think it's unfortunate that so-called Mormon studies is viewed solely through the Brigham Young lens. That's being normative and all the rest are not. My little term paper ended up being very popular among the seminary teachers, and it was also the beginning of what has now become apparently my life's work on the divergent paths of the Restoration. In fact, Samuel W. Taylor once honored me by naming me as the Truman Officer of the Smith-Rigdon movement. It was a real unique pleasure to know Sam Taylor personally, and those of you who may have known him know what a marvelously interesting person he was. Nothing came out of his mouth that wasn't something that was interesting. So my first book, Divergent Paths of the Restoration, was published during my freshman year at BYU, and the fourth edition is still in print. It was 20-some years ago, and I keep trying to work on it, but I keep having trouble with retinal detachments, and I thought my summer was already planned until that happened. Anyway, those of you who are interested, it is coming. It just may take a little longer than even I had hoped. But this all became an intellectual foundation for my mission experience, but I was really unprepared for the regimentation, the extreme authoritarianism, and the realities of work on the ground, contributed to what I perceived as an unethical bait and switch tactic on the part of the church. In those days, we had 7 missionary lessons. My recollection is that we were asked by the mission president to not give the discussion on tithing until after people were baptized. And I found that rather unethical, because you couldn't be a faithful member of the church without paying full tithing. And if you didn't know about that going into it, I just didn't feel like that was honest. And we were also not to give the discussion on the temple, because in Korea at the time, married couples were not allowed to each hold a passport and to leave the country together. And the nearest temple for LDS folks was outside the country, so they could never, ever be sealed in the temple. And so we just didn't want to approach the subject, apparently, so they wouldn't be disappointed. But as I founded the Pagan in Korea, I met thousands of faithful Buddhists and hundreds of faithful Christians who were living the ideals of their religious and faith communities. And I could sense the only thing that I could call what was moving through them is the Holy Spirit. And after my mission, I returned to Korea to work, I got married, and I found that my mother-in-law was a more faithful Christian than I thought possible, and she wasn't even a member of the true church. She was a Presbyterian. She wasn't zealous. She wasn't a firebrand. She wasn't the stereotypical, out there, shouting people, join the true church and burn in hell. She was a simple, humble lady who read the Bible every day, who prayed every day. She would get up at 4 in the morning so she could have an hour of quiet to pray and read the scriptures. She would go to church on Sunday and come home just filled with enthusiasm. The Holy Spirit was present in church today, and I said, Mom, I don't know how that can be, because God surely would never send the Holy Spirit to a false church. It would only be resident in the LDS church. I couldn't explain it. I just couldn't explain it. So over the next few years, I worked hard. I was active in church. I tried to pay a full tithing, even though I sometimes didn't have money to pay for groceries. In the spring of 81, there was this document that came to light, later being proved it fraudulent, but at the time, everyone thought it was authentic, that seemed to give credence to the claims of the Community of Christ succession argument. But from the extreme PR spin that the LDS Church authorities put on that, I got suspicious. They were worried. They were trying to dispel fallout, I thought. So I went to my books and I poured over the small collection of RLDS books in my library, and what I found was stunning. The basic framework of theology and practice, the openness with belief and history, the community-based congregational organization fit very well with my own thinking that I had distilled from my own reading of the scriptures and other books over my, up to then, rather short lifetime, but my lifetime nonetheless. RLDS Church? I've been to one of their services. I've Bible bashed with some of them at the state fair. I've met several in Nauvoo. And, you know, some were friendly, some were obnoxious. They had huge axes to grind, found out that they were ex-Mormons. So I hopped in the car one summer. I lived in Bountiful and I came here to the Holiday area where the church is. What I found in that small group that I met there was a warm, welcoming spirit. They all knew what it was because they could see the smile through my shirt. Some of your younger generation never wore those kind, I think. But no one pressured me. The branch president and his wife invited me home for lunch. They didn't even know me. I just showed up at the door of the church. We ended up visiting for several hours. Later they confessed that they thought I would never leave. But they never tried to push me out the door. They were so generous. My tentative feelings at first began to be replaced by a sense of belonging. It wasn't doctrine. It wasn't interpretation. As much as it was acceptance of me for who I was, who I am, and who I could become, despite all the negative baggage that I brought with me. I took the plunge in September of 1981. Plunge, literally, and figuratively. But I was still a product, and I still am a product, of my heritage, my training. And even now, some of the old tapes play. I eventually learned the new jargon, the different hymn book, began to understand how to shape the message in a way that was inviting rather than selling. And I came to realize that there was, indeed, only one true church, and that was a church of the God's making. Inclusiveness, beyond human comprehension, beyond human administrative processes. God might call a human organization into being for a mission, but to believe an earthbound institution is God's, only true institution takes away from God's glory. A lot of people brought up the iron rod story from the Book of Mormon. And the iron rod was equated with the institution. I began to equate that with the path of discipleship. I think equating it with the institution of the church is a false metaphor. In Community of Christ, I found a place that I could belong and explore and express my faith in ways that people could question but not criticize or condemn. And that was refreshing to me. The Community of Christ tries to be accepting, tolerant, inclusive, and loving. Not everybody gets it right all of the time, but that's what we try for. I'm told that my time's a little short, so I'm going to jump here. So I started to become what I call a crotchety, old, anti-Mormon, and I didn't want to be that. And I made some first tentative steps back to the Mormon History Association, come back to Sunstone a little bit, but I was a little afraid to get too deeply involved because I'd burnt the bridge, and I wasn't sure I wanted to build one back, but the bridge got really bad, despite my best efforts to avoid that. And the bridge was built back, started to be built for me on the way back by some good friends, including the bishop who processed my excommunication, who stayed my friend and supported my decision rather than the official position of how you should treat an excommunicated apostate. I've met several general authorities through the church history connection who have built those bridges back too. And in fact, I asked one of them, said, are you sure it's okay for a general authority to have lunch with an excommunicated apostate? And he said, oh, Steve, I've never thought of you as that. You're just a good friend. And I wish more LDS folks would take that approach to people who see things differently. The bishop who excommunicated me, well, excommunicated the court did. He ended up as temple president in Tahiti. I was there 2 years ago. And we found out that each of us was there and we hadn't had a lot of contact. He said, Steve, you can't come to Papeete and not come and have dinner with me and my wife. And I did. And it was great to be in a home where I knew that I was loved because of who I am and who I've chosen to be part of rather than some stereotyped cookie cutter person, which is my criticism if I were to talk about what the LDS idea might seem to be. And to be in the official temple president's residence, overlooking the beautiful Papeete temple and the sunset over the ocean of the distant island, it was just like being home. And I felt very warm with that. And there are others, lots of folks here. There are still friends from when I was at BYU who didn't want me to take the road, but supported the road that I took, and we're still friends. And we still talk about church. My family are all still in the church. My baby sister's pretty sure she's out now after the ordained woman thing, Kate's excommunication. That's just the icing on the cake as far as she's concerned, of all a long litany of problems that she sees. So we have some interesting conversations about that, and I'm not sure where her faith community will be. I don't recruit members. I invite people to Christ, and they will find Christ wherever Christ is for them. And I think that is how I've been able to come to grips with my bridges and my heritage, and how I've been able to build a bridge back into my heritage and claim it for my own, even though I am not a member or don't ever care to be a member of the LDS organization. My name is Steve, and I'm one.
I'm Jeff Burden. I'm very honored to be able to respond to these two excellent people and their experiences. I'll make my comments quick so you'll have to wait for that time. Ask their questions. But I think we can see here that everyone has a different experience, don't they? And over the last 40 years, whatever it is that I've been doing, I've heard hundreds of stories, and maybe thousands, I don't know. And everyone is unique, everyone is different, and yet there are some threads that run through those. We can see. Just out of curiosity, how many of you are here for your first Sun's Level symposium?
No address.
Well, I hope you find what you're looking for here. But you know, these common threads, I picked up on a few, I wrote them down. I've heard these things you said once before. My journey out was excruciating. All the wasted years, my anger, my depression, uncaring LDS members who don't understand what I'm going through, kind of thing. people telling me I should try harder. My bishop came to my house. My family keeps trying to show me where I'm wrong. And, you know, those kind of things, I think they're pretty consistent. And I'm sure most of you are in some sort of a situation with you or someone in your family, perhaps, who have experienced these experiences. We all have to face up to a decision sometime for people like us. That is, are we going to stay or are we going to leave? And surprisingly, we can do both. Maybe we've seen that or anything, but let me get back to that in just a minute. I want to tell you a little bit, a couple of other thoughts before I get back to that. I was really heartened by Elder Holland's talks at recent conferences, and President Uthor's talks at recent conferences, too. And Elder Holland has reached out to some of us personally. And I have a sense that they really represent the official church position, at least at that level, and maybe for the future. And I hope to see more of these kind of talks and discussions in the future to give us hope. But we have to recognize that it takes 5 or 10 years for what people hear in the pulpit downtown before it translates into the hearts and minds of people at the ward level. I think some of you know I was asked to serve a mission. I'm not sure what you get into it, but the farther up the chain of command you go, the more accepting you are. My bishop hesitated to give me a temple recommend and didn't want me to go on mission. And maybe that's a bit too harsh. He was wondering, hey, are you really qualified yet? So we both agreed that I would write the first presidency and see if they agree it'd be okay. And President Boyd K. Packer actually called my bishop and said, look, let's go. I'll bring that up. I don't know what the words were exactly, but so even though Boyd K. Packer has kind of a hard line reputation, he's the one that called. How that happened, I don't know. But you know, when I got downtown, when I had an office downtown, the church office building, I had no problem with anybody out there. Everybody just accepted me the way I was. Perfectly fine. So I think we need to give a little slack to the board members. We recognize that what they think and what they learned all those years would be hard to turn around.
Jeff, excuse me for interrupting you, but from the context, it sounds as though you were being called on the mission at age 19. You want to add a few details about the particular mission you got?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. This was a mission that I just served for maybe 6 or 7 years ago. It was a service mission.
And it involved?
It involved working with their risk management. Working with health and safety kind of issues and so forth. But anyway, that's just a comment I want to make. I don't think we should ignore President Gore's talk, and I do hope that that's what the future is going to bring. I'm going to be patient with my board members too. You know, we hear all the time, well, I heard him talking, you know, doubt your doubts. That's what they do. That's why it's hard to translate that. And I say, well, yeah, he said that, but he also said that almost everybody in here has questions about it. Here's that gamut you can try. And what if you had a question during your lifetime, and how would you deal with it? You could respond, what? You know, then you'll get some responses. It's a good question that they don't hear very often. Well, let's talk about going back to the staying or leaving issue. Weren't you at the Navigating the Borderlands session of the conference you did not long ago? Maybe something there. I gave a talk. In other words, one person talking about how to lead successfully, and I was given the assignment talking about how to stay successfully. Just what I've been trying to do, help people who want to stay. I've had friends. I mean, a friend of mine got baptized into the church and he came from another religion. just vacant. And after 6 or 8 months, he just decided to open the building. And he left, and he had a place to go to, right back home. You know, perfectly fine. He came in, did work for him, he's back home, and he's perfectly happy. What we need to do, if we decide we're going to stay or leave, which eventually most of us have to decide on, we have to figure out a way to manage that decision, whatever it is. And for living, leaving, I was talking about staying, but I found that those who leave, if they leave for a reason, or let's not so much a reason, if they leave with a destination in mind, they're going to another church, they're going to do something else, then it's easier to be. But even in leaving, I'm not sure we ever do it perfectly. And we can't stay perfectly. It's a continuum between that staying and leaving. We're going to be halfway between, some people are halfway between leaving and staying. And that's what we call the borderlands on the call and so forth. People are kind of left, but they're still there. They're staying, but they're partly gone. The parts they don't like, they give up. But anyway, I've got a little handout here that lists 12 principles that I think you can follow if you're thinking about some, you know, the first few are up to the point where you make your decision, but sorry, all my stuff I've got with me over there. And I've got a handout after we get that, if you'd like to have a handout on the table up here about this, but these principles, I'll just run over them quickly. The first thing you need to do if you're at that point where you need to decide what to do, do a self-assessment. Where am I? What do I like about the church? What do I like? Write some lists down, things that you want to hear about in your life. What do I believe? What do I doubt? Where am I? Where should I be? Those kind of things too. Reassess yourself after you can. Give yourself plenty of time. Don't do it in a week or a month. Keep yourself plenty of time. And then the second thing is to manage your loss of belief. Well, you know, we can see that Hillary, she's still dealing with the loss. We can see that in her anger, in her frustration. And, you know, I know you're going to make that eventually. You've done a great job. But I suspect that you're not quite through with your grieving process. And you know, that's one of those things, it's the Kubler-Ross thing, you know, you go through that denial, anger, negotiation, depression, and acceptance phases and all that kind of thing. And most of us are probably here still in part of that. We're all dealing with that all the time. I still need to feel those sometimes. So, the future will look brighter for you, trust me. And the next thing I suggest you do is to get help. There are people who have been through this before. They can help you. Counselors can help you. You know, don't think you have to do this journey all by yourself. Somebody can help you. And it might be a spouse. Understand the spouse. Or friends. People in the borderlands, those kind of things. And then item four is to finally make some kind of decision. I think I'll leave, or I think I'll stay, or some combination of those two. But eventually you have to decide. You can't just let it sit around not making up your mind. You then just have filled with anxiety, and you're frustrated, and you're in limbo. Eventually you have to decide for yourself, okay, I'm going to try it. Maybe you can change your mind. You can always leave the door open to come back, or leave it, make your own choice. But then we have to make sure that decision is based on our needs, our family's needs, our friends, and other kinds of issues. I think if this is something that's going to be something you have to give it a thought, maybe get help. Something that will be good, help you make that decision. And then the fifth one is, because I'm going to slip in from once this day, I'm already able to have too much information about how to deal with leaving. I think you've done this even quite well. And Hillary, you're on the top of the road. So, define what, if you decide you're going to stay, you then have to define what you mean by stay. Obviously, you're not going to be a true believer. I've never seen one person recover to me and say, Well, I used to disbelieve, and now I'm back to full belief. I still believe everything. No, but in my entire career in this thing, I have heard that. Now, it's not to say it would happen. God, it didn't happen, but it's a rare occurrence if it does. So we have to define what we mean. What will I do? What will I do? Will I know where the line is? Will I go to church? Will I know about the temple of death? Will I know about my tithes? And so forth. You have to kind of make a decision on that. And that leads you to number six, which is develop a model for your religious life that's compatible with the Mormon model. The more we know the Mormon model is 3-hour long temple attendance and so forth and so on, all the way down the line. And you have to decide, okay, I'm gonna believe in Christ as my Savior, but well, I think Keller, you're already starting to make that. You see Christ as not as a, you don't know whether or not he's your the eternal Savior of mankind, but you know the teachings of him or something that you really are attracted to. I might get that wrong. Okay. I think you said what you were talking about.
I'm not getting that wrong.
Okay, good. Then, after you've kind of built this model up, and again, you can be flexible with it, because you can change it as time goes on. The next step is to determine how your model is going to affect the people around you. Your second sick and others. When's your spouse going to think about this model? Your kids, your parents, your friends, and so forth. And well, the next one is maintain and protect your important relationships. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard. My wife says she's going to divorce me. I can't possibly do this. So we have to be careful and make sure that it's your relationship. You know, there's a marriage and family relationship is way more than any church relationship you have. You got to maintain that as one of your goals, I think. And number nine is to create and enhance your motivations to stay. You know, guilt and fear are part of the motivation of being active, true believing, doing all the things they do in the Bible. So we have to substitute the guilt and fear are going to drop away from you. You have to substitute in like, I'm going to do it because I like people. I love people. Or I love Christ. Or something else is going to have to substitute for those. The loss of fear and guilt, which is quite frankly a benefit of starting to go this road. And finally, we're going to come down to the last few. Try to be open and not thoughtfully honest with others. We don't need to be brutal about it. We can be thoughtful. I tell people what I think they need to know. I don't want them to think I'm something I'm not. But I'm not going to disturb somebody's faith or their beliefs if what I tell them is going to do that. So I'll just keep that. So try to be honest. But if we're not honest, you can never make any of this work. Eventually, you've got to get to be honest. It's still over time. I was on with my bishop, and I still went on a mission. That fact, I had an office in the church. I was doing. Everybody knew what I was, where I was coming from. But because I was willing to be supportive, I wasn't being distracted, then I was okay. And you can do this. You can find a way to do that too. And the last item is try to fit the definition of LDS acceptable as much as you can. If you can continue to obey the word of wisdom, do it. If you can continue to wear the garments, do it. I have to have a t-shirt anyway. It just makes my Mormon friends more comfortable if I have the garments on. So those are some examples of this, but I'll have this handout for you. I'd like to start the questions by asking our two excellent presenters. And I was thoroughly impressed with both of your papers, both of your if you very interesting, useful things, Lars, and I think we all gain by hearing you speak. But let me ask you, is it okay for me to ask this question?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll ask the question. Get Brian to come up, and then you guys will, if you'll answer this question. I'd like you to tell us what you think people here should do to avoid some of the problems that you've experienced over the years that you've been doing this. Well, anyway, thank you so much. It's great to be with you. Congratulations to both of you. Great papers.
Wow.
Wonderful. Thank you all for your wonderful presentations. Before we open up for questions, I wanted to share a couple of my thoughts as well, if I can get this thing to go. But one of the things I wanted to comment on, I don't know if this is something that I like about myself, but I seem to have this talent of finding blog posts and articles that like infuriate me. Spiritual gift, I guess. But it seems like whenever there's something controversial or going on, I'm always finding those articles and then I can't step away from them. But one of the things that always is one of my biggest concerns and really frustrates me, no matter what the issue is or these, whatever the problem that people are arguing about, is this. That I don't understand is this message of when you see that where members will say, well, if you don't like it, then why don't you just leave? You know, why would you stay in this place that is causing you pain or that you disagree with or some of these things? I think, at least for me personally, I think for a lot of people, like the news of Kate Kelly being excommunicated has been kind of a very emotional thing, and there was one article about that, and all these people in their comments just saying these mean things to each other, wherever you are on any side of the arguments or what's going on, people are just being so mean. There was one lady that I remember who was saying, I'm so sick of this woman, why wouldn't she just leave, you know? And to me, it's like, what is wrong with us that we would, as members of the church, you know, that we would kind of have that reaction? Don't we want people to be here with us? Don't we want to be loving and embracing those who are struggling, even if we disagree with them? And, I ended up going and talking to my bishop about this, and this is where it's difficult, and maybe we can discuss how are some of these better ways to be able to prevent burning these bridges? Because I think that's what's going on. But like, as I was talking to my bishop, I would say those things where it's like, okay, yeah, whatever you happen to feel on this issue, why can't we treat each other nicer? And he kind of just didn't really get it. But one thing that I would say is that there have been so many who I have seen who do get it, who are trying to be more compassionate and loving, and I think that's kind of something that we can all be doing. So anyways, I want to go ahead and open up for questions. Go ahead and make sure you speak into the microphone so that as it's being recorded. And the first question, if you guys would like to address Jeff's one question.
What should people do to avoid some of the problems that either of us have experienced?
The question was,
if you want to restate it.
Okay.
Basically, what would you recommend for people in our audience that they would maybe go down the journey you've been on to avoid all of the pitfalls, the more difficult things that have happened to you? Do you have any suggestions for anybody, or is it?
Therapy. Lots and lots of therapy. And setting good boundaries with your family. Just saying, you know, because usually if you talk about the church, you will fight. And that's it. So just say, let's not talk about the church, because we'll fight. And, you know, go from there. That helped me, at least.
Not long after my mother died in 2006, I decided that I needed to mend or build bridges with my father, who had written me off as, I don't know what's wrong with that kid, he's some kind of a preacher or something. And so I thought, he was in a nursing home in Ogden, and so I made trips here just to visit him and also my youngest sister who lives in Ogden. And I thought one of the ways that I might rebuild bridges with him was to go to the sacrament meeting that they have at the nursing home with him and sing out of the hymns and do the stuff that's done in sacrament meeting in nursing homes. And he was glad that I was there and glad that I'd come back to church. And so they start serving the sacrament. I was sitting here and he was sitting to my right and they came this way. They served him and helped him because his hands weren't working very well. And they reached over to serve me, and my dad grabbed the hand of the guy that was serving and said, "He can't have any. He's an apostate." And of course, the whole room turned and looked. And it was like, "Oh, Dad." But I just took it. Next time I went to sacrament meeting with him, I took my own sacrament. I swung through the Starbucks drive-thru on the way. And I took my sacrament while they were having theirs. But we made peace. And one of the things that was very difficult, though, was that well-intentioned members of the branch leadership, whenever I would visit, would come and sit with Dad and I at lunch and, "Oh, Steve, I found this testimony of one of your members who became LDS, and I thought you'd appreciate hearing that. And what do I do? My dad's here. I'm trying to reconcile with him. Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate you thinking of me." Ripping it into pieces. It's tough because we don't know what to say to someone who is uncomfortable with our community, who's chosen to join with another community. We sometimes just don't know what to say. And like you, Hillary, my brother and I do not talk religion. We simply can't and still have a peaceful relationship as siblings. My brother and his family are so Mormon, they make Thomas S. Monson look like a wimp. So we just don't talk religion. And that's sometimes maybe the best thing we can do at times.
I guess you guys heard my cane through the microphone. Anyways, Hillary, I want to mostly direct this to you. I'm sorry, I feel like I'm beating a dead horse to death again. But, and I apologize in advance if I offend you because I'm not subtle. That's probably why I'm like perpetually single. But anyways, my question for you is, it seems obvious to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems obvious that you are, as am I, on the way out of the church and have made the conscious choice to be involved in the process of leaving. And that being the case, being inactive for 6 years, what is it that brings you back to Sunstone? And applying that, what do you think the church at large could learn from Sunstone to make it a more welcoming place? Thank you.
Thank you. What brings me back to Sunstone is the people. I really like the people here. And I think the LDS Church could learn from that. Because every time I've come here, I felt welcome. And that was not something I felt at church. And I think a lot of people don't feel that way at church. So we come to communities like this.
And this is a question for Hillary also. Jeff talked about your current emotional state as being part of the five stages of grief. And I was wondering if you had any response to that, whether you also think of your current state in that way, and if so, whether you find it helpful, and if not, why you don't. Thanks.
I think I've grieved for the church again and again because I keep getting drawn in. I get to the point where I'm at peace and then something happens and it all starts over. Anyway, like with the ordained women movement and the dust up following that, I worry about my nieces and I worry about my nephews and how they will think of women. And then I start grieving again. So that's it's something that grief doesn't stop. It just it's a maze.
I have a question for Steve. It seems to me that one of the great values of Sunstone is that it provides a place for a diversity of voices. It encourages a diversity of voices, even if those voices are sometimes wildly divergent, verging on the cuckoo sometimes. Now, I know the Community of Christ has a long tradition of accepting diversity and encouraging it, and could you draw on your historical knowledge to say how such a tradition starts and how to foster it? Because I don't think the LDS Church is very successful at doing that.
Well, I don't think any of us love for the cuckoos very much. We'll try to put them to rest real quickly. I think probably it's the difference in how the two churches were formed after Joseph Smith was killed. Brigham Young and the apostles who were with him in England were one party. The other apostles were in several other parties. Most of the people who came with Brigham Young were British converts who were living in Nauvoo and had no other place to go. They couldn't go back home. The Midwesterners who were part of the original church were earlier converts, but they had family connections all throughout the United States, east of the Mississippi, and had places that they could be. So these outlying branches kind of stayed in place, and the reorganization came about over those 15 or 16 years after Joseph Smith's death by forming a coalition of all these different disparate branches of the original church who each had developed their own personalities and their own take on things over those years with no central authority in place. So Joseph Smith III was a coalition builder. And the only way that it would work was for him to allow all the differing opinions to be expressed. And the Saints Herald, which was the church magazine from 1860, and you know continues today, but in those early years, it was a debating forum. And one of the apostles would write an editorial about his take on this topic, and then the next issue, another apostle would counter that argument with a different perspective completely. And so right from the top down, that discussion and that disagreement, faithful disagreement, because they were all faithful to the cause and they had that foundational principle, several that they agreed on. But the other stuff was open for debate, and it took years. I mean, we published the Book of Abraham in 1864 in the Saints Herald, but Book of Abraham has never been added to the canon of Scripture in the Reorganization Community of Christ. Several of the branches were practicing baptism for the dead until well into the 1870s, but baptism for the dead has never been an acceptable doctrine in the Community of Christ, and it was never practiced by the Church. It was never accepted by Joseph Smith III. So I'm not sure that lessons can be learned from that. I think it has to be the experience of how that community was shaped. You know, Sunstone's had a hard time. I've been a member, I've been a subscriber of Sunstone since 1975 when it first started. Sometime in the early 80s when President Kimball was living at the Hotel Utah and we had our Sunstone conference there, was taken out the hallway and saw the signs, "What's this Sunstone?" And his aide said, "Oh, it's some kind of travel convention." You know, we were blacklisted basically by the church authorities for having diversity of opinions. So If what Jeff is saying about Elder Holland, President Hoopdorf, and some of the others, and you know, and I sense this openness in the few general authorities that I know, maybe there is a shift coming, and there is a trend toward, you know, maybe there are places at the table for everybody, but the church authorities may not realize it isn't their table, but the table's bigger than them. And I hope that they would realize that at some point, but I'm not sure they can learn lessons from the likes of me.
One of the hardest things in the world is for active faithful members of the church to conceive or accept the fact that some people would leave the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints when it imitates so closely the Church of Christ established on the earth with the same organization, the same doctrines, the same ordinances. But it should not really be surprising, because the sixth chapter of Luke says that some of the disciples of Jesus ceased to walk after him, stopped walking after him. They became offended, who knows what. So isn't one of the questions we should ask ourselves as we ponder, or those, I shouldn't say we, but those who ponder leaving, am I leaving for some of the same reasons that people left Christ, stopped walking after him, even though they saw him perform miracles, they heard him preach, they still left his own disciples. So we can't be surprised if some of the members of the Church of Christ today are going to leave. It could be that some of them were offended because of bullying, for example. The apostles were some of them kind of bullying because Paul says that part of the purpose of apostles and prophets was to, for the perfection of the saints, of the ministry, that we no more be tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. Did they go too far in trying to prevent people being deceived by every wind of doctrine? And Christ himself, was he a bully when he drove the money changers out of the temple, when he said, "I came not to bring peace, but the sword"? Or is there really, truly, a good reason for all of that? And we must not confuse, I think, bullying with the sincere efforts of church leaders to try to fulfill their duty to bring perfection to the saints. Your comments?
Well, I'm sure all of us can resonate somewhat with your testimony, but to posit that 50 East North Temple is the true Church of Christ is a false assumption. Brigham Young is the one who was wrong, who left the church, who introduced doctrines that were false and not scriptural based. So out here in the Salt Desert, I'm afraid you're the folks that are wrong. And those of us in the Midwest are left to fend for ourselves and try to reclaim the truths that Joseph Smith taught. Well, how do we know? That's the real question. I, of course, don't say that as my testimony. That's the old argument that my people in the reorganization would use. A community, a church, is no truer than the people in the pews are true to the gospel of Christ. I don't care what the leaders are trying to do or what they're saying. I don't care how many beautiful buildings you build. And if the people in the pews and the ward are not a true community, they cannot represent Christ. They do not represent Christ. When you have artificially constructed communities by drawing geographical boundaries and you lose that organic nature of what community is all about, I think you head down the road of creating a community that can't accept my sister here for who she is and rejects her. And I think there's for all organized religion, a lot of soul searching that needs to be done to really truly figure out what church really means. And my argument is that it's not an institution, but it's the people.
One of the questions I've been asked again and again is, were you hurt by the church or were you hurt by its culture? And my only response can be, by their fruits ye shall know them. And the culture is the fruit of the church. So I would say they are one and the same. Like he has said, the church is the people. And if, for example, I've had people quote Boyd K. Packer as saying, God would not be so cruel as to create people who are gay. So apparently God didn't create me, which is not a great thought to have. And if this is a prophet of the Lord, that's a very painful thing to hear. I can't accept that. I can't believe in a God who would tell me that I'm an abomination. I'm sorry if that's painful for you, but that's something I can't believe in.
Hogging the mic, and see, this is coming at you without any preparation at all. But could you comment on the Community of Christ's statement of faithful descent? I was so impressed when I read that.
Well, you know, as I alluded to earlier, in that coalition that Joseph Smith III hobbled together to try and create something, I think back up. 2 or 3 years ago, we published a document on faithful dissent and laid out guidelines for how we as a community of Christ's disciples can move forward, even though we may not all be 100% in agreement with the others on every single point of what it might be that is in front of us. We put that into practice last year in April when we had a national conference for the churches in the United States, for the areas of the United States. And they were discussing the role of LGBT community in the church and how we might deal with marriages and ordination. Not everybody in the church is 100% in agreement with the decision that was made, but we had a discussion, very open, among several hundred people who gathered to that conference. They followed the principles of how it is we can discuss things and still do it in peace and in love. But we're a very open, democratically organized community where more and more the prophet of the church is moving us to being a prophetic people rather than a people with a prophet who simply dictates what we ought to do, and letting the body discern God's will collectively over long periods of time and coming to testimonies of what that might be. So the statement on faithful dissent, faithful disagreement, I think is what we call it, is on the church's website, cofchrist.org, put in faithful disagreement, and you'll see that document if you want to look at it further. But it's based on those principles that, as the body of Christ, it's a collective that works on the solutions to the problems, not a group of people that waits for somebody at the top to tell us what to do.
Thank you. All right, thank you all so much for your preparation and your talks, and thank you, everyone.